Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the double pleasure of speaking with Dr. Yigal Bronner, who's Associate Professor in the Department of Asian Studies at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and also Dr. Lawrence McRae, who is Professor of Sanskrit Studies in the Department of Asian Studies at Cornell University. They are both co-editors of a fascinating brand new publication. It's an OUP publication coming out any minute now. First Words, Last Words, New Theories for Reading Old Texts in 16th Century India. Gentlemen, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having us.
My pleasure. So I'm sure the subtitle says much towards answering this, but you know, what is this book about? What is the primary object of study for this book?
So the book has a sort of dual focus. It's about a very specific controversy that took place in 16th century India, South India, between several major theologians and scriptural theorists of scriptural interpretation. The most famous of them is Abhaya Dikshita, who is a really important intellectual in many fields, and both Dr. Bronner and I have worked on him in various domains before. And he's a great figure in poetics, poetic theory, what's called Vedanta, which is a kind of scriptural hermeneutic theological, sometimes called philosophy, but it's kind of a borderline discipline. And what the book is mainly centrally about is what's called Mimamsa, which is kind of the Vedic theory of scriptural interpretation. So he wrote this book called The Power of the Opening sometime in the late 1500s, not exactly sure. And it's specifically an attack on another great scriptural theorist from a rival tradition, this fellow named Vyasatirtha, who of the Dvaita, the dualist Vedanta tradition. And basically he wrote a book-length attack, short book, on this particular question of interpretation. And the question is this. The question is, when we interpret texts, do we allow the opening, the earliest portion of the text that we read, to dictate our interpretation of what follows? That's to say, is the opening more powerful than the closing, or is the closing, the later part of the text, force us to reinterpret what we've seen before? And we try and chart the history of this controversy for about 1,000 years before this, but it's really in this moment in the 16th century that this bursts onto the scene as a really important issue. To very, very briefly be reductive about it, Vyasatirtha, the dualist, following his master Madhva, who founded the dualist tradition, says that the closing always wins, right? That when we read something and then something else later in the text contradicts it, we revise our interpretation of what came before. And Abhaya Dikshita, following this earlier tradition of Mimamsa, says, no, it's the other way around. Once we start reading a text, it tells us what it's about and it forms a sort of pre-understanding that dictates our interpretation of what comes later. So what we read first kind of sets the terms of our understanding, and everything that comes later has to be fit into that. So there's a little bit of a back and forth. Vyasatirtha asserts the power of the closing. Abhayavichita, in this book, The Power of the Opening, rejects this. And then Vyasatirtha's grand pupil, Vijayendratirtha, around the same time, a little bit later than Abhayavichita, they were contemporaries and knew each other. He writes a rejoinder to that, defending the power of the closing again. So these three texts are really the centerpiece of the book, and the middle chapters are mainly about kind of investigating their arguments and exploring how they work. And then as we sort of investigated this debate around the question of sequence, we decided that we wanted to expand on this in two ways. One is to look in a broader cross-cultural context at how other scriptural traditions, mainly the Abrahamic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, investigate the question of sequence. So we have sort of large comparative sections in the introduction and conclusion. And the other thing we wanted to do is think about this specific debate about a specific question in the broader context of Indian intellectual life in the 17th century. And for several decades now, there's been a recognition that this is a period of self-great and self-conscious novelty. There's a period of what's come to be called the new intellectuals. And we wanted to sort of investigate the ways in which innovation happens in a largely, at least outwardly, traditionalist intellectual culture, such as India. Some people have argued that while there was this period of innovation, the innovation was in some ways constrained or limited by the perceived need to conform to existing truths and existing propositions in already known systems, and that there was what both of our common teacher, Sheldon Pollack, has called newness of the intellect constrained by an oldness of the will. And we wanted to not attack, but to sort of nuance this understanding and suggest that that there is a newness going on beneath the surface that's sometimes masked by a guise of traditionalism. So that's the basic story of the book, if that makes sense.
Yes, you touched on a great many aspects of the book. That was a great introduction. So a couple of the themes that you touched on, I'll maybe draw out a little more clearly. So maybe the best way to do this is, who would most be interested in this book? I know you touched on that, but let's draw that out a bit more.
So it's an interesting book in that it addresses different audiences. It's something that I think is a little bit unusual in the field of South Asian studies. So the core chapters of the book that chart this kind of pamphlet war, this controversy about the question of the place of sequence in scriptural interpretation and scriptural hermeneutics, there, especially, you know, chapters 3 to 5, that each of which has a hero, each of which has a main text, they're kind of hardcore philological and philosophical and historical studies of the arguments in these texts, and they're addressed more to students and people who are interested in the intellectual history of India, in the history of the new intellectuals in India, that is the setting of the social and political and historical setting of 16th and 17th centuries India, the kind of the main camps, the Shaivas and the Vaishnavas, adherents of Shiva and adherents of Vishnu, the dualists, the non-dualists, the Vishishta Advaitins, the qualified non-dualists, all these like big positions in Indian intellectual history and Indian philosophy and Indian theology of the period. So people want to know about Vedanta, people who want to know about Mimamsa, they would like to read these central chapters. But the book also addresses people who are interested in more general questions, two general questions that Larry touched upon. One is the question of innovation. How does innovation happen within a traditional system of thought? And how do people allow themselves to express new ideas within the constraints? And how is this different between, let's say, early modern India and other contexts, such as early medieval Europe or other periods in Islamic thought and Jewish thought. So people who are interested in these questions would be very interested in chapters 1 and 6 of this book, which do not, you know, necessitate a lot of pre-knowledge of these kind of hardcore Sanskrit intellectual questions or Indian philosophical questions. And then another crowd, I think, who might be interested in this book are people who are interested in comparative hermeneutics and questions of sequence in hermeneutics. It turns out, and this is something we discovered when we wanted to broaden our horizons here, that the question of sequence is a dominant question in these different hermeneutic traditions. And they came up on the one hand, so especially the Abrahamic traditions, each on its own and together, came up with very different answers to the question than, let's say, our heroes in this book, Vyasatirtha, Apayadikshita, Vijayendratirtha, such people. But at the same time, the methodology is interestingly sometimes very similar, and there are many interesting overlaps. So I think people who are interested in scriptural hermeneutics in these traditions would also be very interested in reading sections of her book, at least.
Yeah, one of the elements of the book that I really appreciated or was intrigued by was this, you know, the very nerdy South Asian nerdy nuts and bolts meat of the sandwich, right? And yet this this much more general comparative, perhaps accessible beyond the subfield, frame, right? the bread of the sandwich. I quite enjoyed that aspect of the book. Say a bit more about these overlaps that you touch on, for example, with Christianity in the book.
Well, there's what really governs our selection, specifically why we looked at medieval Christianity and the other periods that we do, is we're interested in the tension between a kind of traditionalist scholastic intellectual culture and this the ways innovation happens. So specifically thinking about the medieval Christian context, you have a situation where there are people who are trying to produce innovations. We specifically focus on this this Peter Abelard, who was a very interesting, very controversial figure, who wants to say everything that I'm writing is just a sort of logical development of the scriptures and the Christian tradition. And I am just offering up commentary and explanation here. I'm not really doing anything new, but who's recognized by his contemporaries as doing quite radical things. And in fact, in the case of medieval Europe, was subject to severe penalties. His works were burned and banned. He was forbidden to write for a certain period of time. So it's very socially, politically, it's a very different context. In India, there was no kind of overt state suppression of opinion. But there are similar dynamics, that there are these sort of long-running, thousand-year-old schools of thought, often with specific foundational texts that people don't want to be seen as violating. And in some ways, there are similar dynamics of wanting to do something new, but not admit that you're doing something new. And what I think is distinctive, I think it's been recognized by many people working in pre-modern Indian intellectual life, that actual innovation is going on all the time, often unacknowledged. One of the focuses of our book that I think is distinctive is that we try to make a serious case in the authors that we are looking at, specifically, especially the later two, Apayadikshita and Vijayendratirtha, that they're not simply subconsciously or tacitly deviating, they are consciously deviating from, you know, they're in some ways compromising the tenets of their own traditions in the interests of a certain theoretical innovation, but that they still want to maintain a pose, an insincere pose, we argue, of faithfulness to the tradition. And that in some cases, at least, these these insincere protestations of tradition were called out and challenged by people within the tradition, as they were in the case of Abelard in Europe. So we're interested in looking at sort of parallels in other traditions to the ways that innovation can happen. You know, so people can sort of sneakily innovate and say, oh, I'm just being a humble commentator on what came before, when they're actually doing quite radical things. And that's what we really wanted to make a case for.
Trojan horsing various interpretations into tradition.
In fact, if I may add something to that.
Absolutely.
So what we discovered is when we read these texts, there is a big gap between the rhetorics of the books from the very title, right? Here's one book saying the victory of the opening, and the other book is called the triumph of the ending, of the closing, and they have this like bombastic rhetoric of how the other is wrong and how I'm right and so on and so forth. But not very deep underneath these kind of rhetorical poses, you find that Abhaya Dikshita is developing an altogether new cognitive theory of how we process information when we read, where sequence play very little, if no role whatsoever. And Vijayendra basically adopts this position, and he's not even trying to show that his position is better, but only that his position is no less good, and therefore that he too could be right. And there is an amazing convergence between their two positions, which under this very thin veneer of traditional posturing, kind of settle on the shared conclusion that the traditional positions, their party lines, their respective party lines, seem less and less to be of relevance to the new discourse that they are both participating in fact, creating, inventing in the 16th century.
Now, would you say that's what struck you most about this research? I don't mean this to be a leading question. You know, what sort of, having looked at this and churned this book out, what sort of sticks out in your mind the most, or perhaps surprised you, intrigued you about what you found out?
Yeah, I think this is one of the most striking things that we discovered. There are several striking things to this literature, at least from my perspective. One is the immense complexity and erudition of the discussion. You really need to be steeped in so many continuous traditions, and you need to know all the publications for about a millennium and running. And you need to know all these methodologies. So it's really uniquely complicated discussions that seem very continuous and present themselves as like we're just defending, we're a little bit, you know, putting the polish on these like well-established, well-formulated traditions and protecting them from these attacks from the others. But what is again really striking is how consciously, knowingly, flippantly, audaciously, the actual positions of the book are different from these rhetorical posturings. Maybe Larry wants to answer.
Yeah, I would concur with all of that. I think that we've both in our earlier works, separately and together to a certain extent, been interested in this, what's new about intellectual life in 16th and 17th century India, what drives this sort of explosion of new texts, new genres. And I think we've both come to the conclusion that certain figures, at least, and Abhaya Dikshita, our central figure in some ways, is one of the main examples. There's a very different way that people relate to their traditions. That Abhaya Dikshita, not just here but in his other works, he has this professional distance, right? He will argue for something that he may or may not really believe. He will argue for different things in different works. he actually writes in two different, somewhat rival schools of Vedanta, defending them both in ways that it's not clear always what his real position is in other works too, in other fields. And he almost invents, or he and his predecessor, Vyasatirtha, we've both argued, sort of invent a sort of new kind of historicist scholarship where each scholar, again, has total mastery of this thousand year or more tradition going behind them. And in a way, the mastery of the complex long tradition gives you a kind of power because you can pick and choose, you can mix and match, you can recombine elements. You can, in a way, create and defend any position you want within a traditional framework. We talk a little bit about this in the book, and Yigal has written it about it elsewhere, that Abhay Dikshita develops this idea of what is called the Sarvatantra Swatantra. The term is not his, but he is kind of the first, in a way, theorist of this. It's the idea of somebody for whom each system is his own system. It's really what the word means. And he defines this as someone who is able to articulate the position of any of the many rival systems of philosophical and theological thought and defend it. So it's a kind of debater's mastery of the intellectual world, such that you can take up any position you want and find a way to defend it, which is, you know, it does display a kind of bravura mastery, but at the same time, it reveals, I won't say a kind of hollowness, but again, a kind of questionable sincerity, right? That you can sort of take up a position for tactical or strategic or political reasons, whether it's really what you believe deep down or not. And there's this distancing. And I think this distancing with what one really believes and what one chooses to argue, that becomes an increasingly evident tone, not only in Abhay Dikshita's own work, but in those of his rivals, especially this Vijayendra who comes after him. And again, as Yigal says, it begins to look like they really agree on a position that sequence is of minimal or no importance, but they are somehow each, for reasons of their kind of social and institutional positioning, choosing to defend these older positions outwardly while developing a theory that really undermines them. And that's really what came to fascinate us about this entire debate.
That is utterly fascinating. Do we have any sense of the impact, the reach that these conversations would have had? Were they sort of cloistered in sort of, you know, in a very small circle of an academic circuit, sort of to use a parallel for today? Would they have, you know, who would have been in on these conversations and or influenced by them in their historical period?
That's an excellent question. I mean, there are two, or at least two ways of looking at this. You know, from the kind of the nuts and balls of this issue of sequence in reading, is sequence in interpreting whether the information given in the beginning of a passage is less or more important than the information given at the end of the passage. You could say that's a kind of a hardcore intellectual question that interested only few people. And indeed, we describe in the end of the book how this controversy kind of petered out without leaving a great deal of impression on the later intellectual history of the late 17th century and 18th century India. But from a different perspective, the warring parties were very important politically, socially, intellectually, in the broad circles of India in the 16th and the 17th centuries, and the debates over, you know, dualism versus non-dualism versus qualified non-dualism were debates that were taking place between, you could say, political parties that controlled funds, that were important in temples, that were important players in a variety of social and economical and political circles that were both in the south, in the first under the kind of the domain of the Vijayanagara city empire, and after it collapsed still in the area, and also had ramifications in other parts of India, all the way up to Benares, which at the same time kind of built itself up as the intellectual center of India, something that is in itself, I think, new and very important. And people were going back and forth between Benares and the south, and between Maharashtra and the south, and between Andhra and the south. And they were debating these kinds of questions, you could say that in some ways it mattered less to the kind of the bigger public what is more important, the opening or the closing, which is anyhow seems not to be at the heart of the matter for Appaya and Vijayendra, but it mattered more who you were. Were you presenting yourself as a non-dualist or as a dualist or as a qualified dualist, and how that impacted your position in a variety of debates that could also be played out and in a variety of disciplines, be it grammar, be it theology, and so on.
Was there anything else about
Sarkoan? So just to concur and supplement that, there's a way in which these debates are very refined, and presumably only a very small group of people would be able to access or make sense of them or be in a position to judge them. But these are not local works. These became, as through the spread to Benares and elsewhere, these became pan-Indian works very quickly. There really was something like a sort of current public intellectual life that was something almost pan-Indian in this period, certainly comprising all of the South, Benares and Bengal and Mithila as major centers of Sanskrit life. And it was tied up in close ways with courts. We talk about this a bit in the final chapter, or the next to the last chapter, that this one particular ruler, two of our main authors, Appaya Dikshita and Vijayendra Dikshita, were actually supported at the court of this one particular ruler in the south, Sevapanayaka. And those two, along with the representative of another major Vedanta tradition, the qualified non-dualists, Tathacharya, they were all there. And he writes this verse in one of his inscriptions about how he has these three premier representatives of these three rival intellectual theological traditions represented at his court, each defending his own position. And we suggest that there's something like a kind of public intellectual culture, or almost a public space, that's developed through this. And that is very important to centers of power. Again, maybe not important to the sort of, large masses of people, but there is a kind of need for this. We don't discuss it in the book, but just at the same time, very famously in the north, in the Mughal Empire, right, Akbar is having these assemblies of pundits where he deliberately brings representatives of all the different religious traditions to have debates with each other. Not necessarily it's not like the story of the Khazars in Europe where the king wants to have all the religious debate and then choose, this will be the religion. It's not really to convert people, it's to have a kind of public disputational culture that acknowledges that there are these multiple traditions that are going to persist, that are not going to be wiped out, but it's important to have them all represented. And another aspect of this, as I think Yigal suggests too, is that even if most dualist Vedantins would not have read or been interested or been able to access these materials in Sanskrit, there is a kind of prestige economy that's linked to the real economy of royal patronage, that it's important to score points for your team. It's important, and that may be partly, we suggest in the conclusion, why this two-level kind of argument persists, where deep down there's a kind of unity between the two positions, but outwardly they maintain this stark pose of opposition, the power of the closing, the power of the opening, that it's important to score points for your team. It's important to score victories for the dualists, and that somebody like Vijayendra Tirtha or Vyasatirtha could score a great intellectual conquest for the dualists is important, even if most people who are followers of dualism don't know or care what the debates are about. Right? There's a kind of intellect. So there's a kind of intellectual culture almost as a kind of, not a sport, but as a kind of public contest that I think has a certain importance, and yet is enshrined in royal courts in a way that suggests its importance.
Well, there's obviously some sort of sparring of swords here, or sparring of pens, at very least. Is there anything else about the book that you wanted to touch on?
Well, I think, I mean, if you have... We want this to be, you know, a sort of interesting study in what for us is a fascinating set of texts. And we hope, despite what you all said about different chapters being used as different people, we tried to write about this very technical debate, and we hope that we'll be intelligible and accessible even to non-specialists. We want people to be able to learn the essentials of this debate, even if you come to this knowing nothing. But we also, you know, we want to make a kind of intervention in the way Indian intellectual history, especially early modern Indian intellectual history, is studied, right? There's a way in which the study of Indian philosophy especially tends to get pigeonholed, that people say, oh, this is what the followers of Mimamsa believe, this is what the followers of non-dualist Vedanta believe. And there's a way of writing about this that kind of reduces the historical complexity and the nuance, just kind of ticks off, you know, what are the main positions of this position. And you can discuss different authors from different periods, but the assumption is they're all basically on the same team, and that non-dualist Vedanta basically is a constant, and dualist Vedanta is a constant. And we want to make a case through this. You can only do it through this kind of detailed reading, but if you actually get into the nuts and bolts of the debates, there's a lot of complexity. In some ways, there's as much contestation going on within these different traditions as there is between them. And that we want to make a case for a certain kind of close reading of these debates with sensitivity to bigger cultural issues. So not just to produce an edition and translation of these short texts, but to sort of examine the debate and try and see how it fits into the broader picture of the individual life and identity of these authors, but also the sort of bigger social political movements of the time. And we tried, you know, in a preliminary way, as all we could do, to sort of address some of these bigger questions in a way that I think we hope will prompt, you know, will encourage similar studies, because this is a one little piece of a vast world of debate, most of which is almost totally unstudied. You know, the materials available to us in early modern India are comparable in scale and complexity and sophistication with what we find in early modern Europe, but the study of it is, by comparison, the study of it by modern scholars is really rudimentary in comparison with European intellectual history, and we think that's something that needs to be addressed, and we're trying in our own way to move in that direction.
So for those of you out there who are grad students or prospective grad students, you heard that there's plenty of stuff here to be studied waiting for you. Yigal, was there anything else you wanted to add about the work?
I think we said most of what we had to say about it, but in a way, what Larry just said is that it's an ambitious book in the sense that it wants to reach and make sense and be intelligible to these different audiences with different levels of background. So we kind of let people in very slowly into the technical stuff, and we want at the same time to make a bold claim about changes and what it really means to be a public intellectual in 16th century India. This is a new question that has only begun to be asked in the last decades, and I think this book will hopefully contribute to our understanding of that question and lead maybe to more studies, because as Larry said, there is so much more to study here.
Great books are always beginnings, it seems to me, more than endings. They're first words, not last words. But you can argue over which is more important. you know, there's a question that I often ask at the outset of most of the podcasts. And of course, since we don't know which is more important, the first or the last, I'll end with this question that I normally ask at the outset. Tell us a bit about the genesis. How did this project come about? You can also mention the connections to the AAR and the series and all that as well. How did this come about?
You know, we asked ourselves this question in preparation for this interview, and it turns out that there are conflicting narratives here between the two.
Oh, good. As a scholar of Puranas, I love this. I'll make sense of them both. Go for it.
So, as Larry said, and on this, I think we totally agree, we are both very much interested in this polymath, in this intellectual towering figure of 16th century India, Appiah Dikshita. And we start reading together his works, even as we were graduate students at the University of Chicago back in the 90s. And then both of us continued to work both separately and together in a variety of areas. But, and here's where the narratives diverge. So this is a work that directly addresses Appiah's main intellectual persona as a scholar of Vedanta and Mimamsa, which is a little bit away from my field of interest, which is mostly poetic theory, Alankara Shastra. So in my imagination of the origin of this project, look, we've been working on this for about 10 years now. And the way we've been working is that we read the text together on mostly on Skype and Zoom. I mean, Larry is in Cornell, I'm in Jerusalem. Occasionally we meet and we have like these more intensive sessions of a few days of reading and writing together. And so my recollection of this is that this must have been Larry's idea, because he's more into Mimamsa and Vedanta, and he somehow dragged me into this sideway from my main area of study. And Larry, I think, has a different story. Maybe he should tell his version.
Well, my account, Beagle is quite right. We've both been interested and written about Appiah Dikshita in particular for a very long time now, decades, I guess I can say. And we've read him for longer together. And that, you know, Beagle is mostly interested in poetry and poetics. I've mostly been interested in Mimamsa and Vedanta, although I have a history of interest in poetics as well. And that my recollection is that Yigal more or less proposed to me that we should begin reading this work of Vedanta. And I was sort of surprised and rather delighted that it's, you know, it's something that was very much music to my ears. But my recollection is the impetus coming from Yigal. It's interesting and characteristic, I suppose, that neither of us can quite remember, or that we remember differently. This is part, I should say perhaps, that this is part of a very long working relationship between the two of us. It's not simply that we were students together. Yeah, I guess 30 years almost, I suppose, since we met. Right? Not quite, but... So we were students together, and we began reading together very early. But we have a sort of extended period of writing collaboration. We've written several articles together over the last, you know, 25 years or so. And most of our projects work arise in a very similar way, which is to say that we begin reading text together without having any particular plan of whether we'll write something or what. And that after we've read something for a while, we sort of say, hey, we should do an article about this, or we should, you know, explore this further, or let's read further and let's go something else. But it's been a sort of seesawing back and forth between just reading, sort of unguided reading together, culminating in writing once we feel like we have something to say. And because we've read together, usually when we have something to say, it's something we feel like we need to say together. You know, that if I remember from our earliest collaboration, I sort of felt like it would be unfair in a way for me to write something about it, because all the thinking had been kind of common thinking. So I think that both of us for a long time, especially for the last, 12 years or so, we Skype for 2 hours every week. And sometimes we read, sometimes we just talk about things. Sometimes we decide to write something. So we've written a couple articles together. As a sort of prelude to this book or a predecessor, we did a panel at the University of Madison conference in, I think, 2014 with several other scholars of Vedanta, where we presented kind of preliminary versions of our takes on particular chapters as separate papers. I wrote a paper on Vyasatirtha's account, and he wrote one on Advaitichitta. But by this time, we had already sort of envisioned this book. So it's a kind of extended collaboration where, yeah, we've been writing, reading, thinking together so long, it's hard to disentangle who thought what first or whose idea something is. And it's become, for me, and I think for Yigal as well, that it's become a kind of parallel intellectual life that I have. You know, I have my own work and my own interests and my own writings, and I have this, what I do together with Yigal, and I think it's the same from the other side. So it's been this extended collaboration that we've, you know, always sought to maintain, and we're already sort of thinking toward the next project at this point and reading. But also it's something that we've tried to foster as a sort of bigger element of Indian intellectual studies. That Yigal, long before I took any steps in this direction, Yigal was part of several large projects in Jerusalem, bringing together scholars reading poetry and poetics for extended periods of time, for in one case for like a year-long research and reading project where people would collectively read together and then, you know, eventually produce papers and produce some edited volumes. But this importance of common reading is something we've both recognized for a long time. More recently, we were both involved with this collaborative research project called The Age of Vedanta, where we tried to gather 10 or 12 scholars, mainly in this kind of early modern period, working on different branches of Vedanta. But we've gone together for three sort of week-long reading workshops where we mostly just sat all day and read together. And, you know, we're planning a volume to come out of this, but it's not like just having people come for a conference and present papers. It's something where you actually study and read and interpret it together, and you develop a different kind of understanding in this way. But I think I see it as an outgrowth of what we've done together with each other, but it's sort of something we see as a broader model for the future.
You know, it may well be that I've spent too much time with the Puranas, but that makes perfect sense to me. What you've said makes perfect sense to me insofar as it's an organic outgrowth. It's the condensation of a cross-pollination that doesn't have a discrete genesis. It's sort of, it's a number of things that I'm glad I asked that question, albeit at the last and not the first, but I'm glad I asked about the genesis of the project, because it points us to a couple of themes that are recursive on the podcast. And one is engagement of text in a meaningful way, familiarity, immersion in text, becoming familiar with the text. That's very different from only understanding it intellectually for a moment. And that requires just exposure. And it's that exposure to the text that then invites the text to prompt the question or the concern or show you the intrigue. It'll, you know, the text will point out what it is you need to comment on. And so it's a really interesting and rich way in which you describe your relationship to text and your relationship to the project and each other. And so I imagine this will not be your last collaboration. For the next one, whenever that may be, you're welcome back on the podcast.
We'd love to. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And thank
years,
you.
In about 10 years.
Another, the next, this one took us almost 10 years. The next one will be roughly as long.
Well, either me or my successor, or who knows. Either way, the invite is open. Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you very much for having us. It was wonderful to talk to you.
Yes, likewise. For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Yigal Bronner and Lawrence McRae, co-authors of a brand new OUP publication that'll be out in August, probably around the same time this podcast is coming out, called First Words, Last Words, New Theories for Reading Old Texts in 16th Century India. until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating the nature of scholastic innovations. Take care.